The Problem of Evil, Part 1. The first talk in a four-part series was presented by Jack Crabtree on July 13, 2012, as part of Gutenberg College's 2012 Summer Institute, What the Bleep Can We Know? The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Welcome. So we're going to devote the whole day to the so-called problem of evil. I'll define that in a second. Rather than, there aren't really great, convenient breaking points in the outline, so what I'm going to do is simply I have this whole relatively coherent argument that I'm going to present, and we'll just, when it comes time to take a break, we'll just stop there and then begin where we left off when we come back. So I haven't divided it into four discrete talks. I've just got one long talk that we're going to make our way through, and it's all here in the notes. I'm just going to kind of read the notes and comment on the notes. And I think the way I'd like to structure it is feel free right in the middle of it, if you have a short question of clarification, to just interject it at any time. So it'll be conversational in that sense. And then I will try to stop each session a little bit early for just other questions and answers that might be a little bit more involved. So those are the ground rules, but I do want to make my way through here. So don't be offended if I cut you off, because we need to make progress. Okay, the problem of evil is actually probably familiar to you. If it's not familiar to you by that title, you're very familiar with the concept. It's simply the idea that if you look around at the world and you see the kind of cruelty and injustice and evil and suffering that is out there in the world. I'm going to talk about both evil and suffering. Sometimes philosophers separate those, but I'm going to talk about both. But when you look out at the world and see the amount and the nature and the kind of evil that's in the world, it just becomes problematic to think that the Judeo-Christian worldview that believes that this world was created by not only a good God, but a perfectly and flawlessly good God, that just seems like a problem. I mean, why would a good God create this mess? Why would he allow it? Why would he bring it into being? That's the problem of evil. So it's reconciling the coexistence of the Judeo-Christian God with the nature and extent and kind of evil that is in the world. So by the Judeo-Christian God, I mean a God who is both utterly sovereign, he controls everything and has the power and the authority to be able to bring into being whatever he wants to bring into being. So it's not like he's unable to eradicate evil, apparently, and yet he's good. So why would a good God who's capable of eradicating evil, why would that be? That's the problem of evil. Well, out of the problem of evil arise several arguments from evil. And I'm going to talk about a few of them here. The first one is the evil in the world as an argument against the existence of the Judeo-Christian God. This is probably the most popular argument that an atheist will give for his atheism. His, I don't believe in God, I don't believe there is a God, because look at the evil in the world. There can't be a God with the world having that kind of evil in it. That's a very, very common, the most popular argument for atheism. Or the evil in the world is an argument against the goodness of God. People may not challenge the existence of God. Sure, there's a God. I don't know how else this world would have come into being, but he ain't good. Whoever that God is, he's not a good God. And what's the evidence for that? The nature and extent of the evil that's in the world. 3, the evil in the world as an argument against the sovereignty of God. That's become especially popular these days with the advent of what's called open theism. Open theism has a whole different concept of God, where God is utterly good, but he's not, he doesn't have the power and the latitude and the authority to actually affect the world the way he wants to affect the world. He's got a bunch of us to deal with, and we mess up the works. So that's become more and more popular. I don't want to challenge the goodness of God, but I most certainly want to challenge the fact that God has the kind of control that the traditional Judeo-Christian God, that traditionally is attached to the Judeo-Christian God. So an argument against his sovereignty. The one I'm going to be concerned about is the fourth one here. The evil in the world as an argument against divine determinism. I'm going to go on in a second to define divine determinism, but because I believe divine determinism, a particular kind of divine determinism, is what the Bible actually teaches, an argument against that is more interesting to me, because we need to meet that challenge. If we're going to believe the biblical worldview and the biblical concept of God, we need to be able to account for the nature and extent of evil in the world if we're going to, with intellectual integrity, believe in that God and believe that worldview. But basically, divine determinism is the perspective that God is not the author of absolutely everything. You know, most things God created, yes, but things like evil, God is not the creator or the author or the cause or the origin of evil. That, again, is a very, very popular argument, because divine determinism is a very minority view in Christian culture today. Most Christians do not believe in divine determinism. So that in order to stave off divine determinism, they will appeal to the problem of evil as the reason why they can't go there and can't believe that. Then finally, and this gets kind of confusing, but the evil in the world is an argument for defiance toward or rebellion against God. That is, it's not that he doesn't exist. It's not that you can't tell me he's good. Okay, maybe he's good. I'll grant you that. Is he sovereign? Yeah, he's sovereign. But whatever he is, he shouldn't be honored, because this place stinks. And I'm not going to honor anybody who is responsible for a place that stinks like this place does. For those of you who sat through the Reformation Fellowship series, I read a section out of the Brothers Karamazov, or my daughter read a section out of the Brothers Karamazov called Defiance or Rebellion, depending upon how they translate it. And for those of you who are not familiar with that, Ivan Karamazov, who's a skeptic, a cynic and a skeptic, is talking to his novitiate brother, who wants to be a priest, about his whole attitude toward God. And he tells these just chilling, horrible stories of children suffering. And the last one in particular is this land noble, this landholder, has some serfs, and a serf boy accidentally hits his prize dog when he threw a rock, and it accidentally hit the paw of his prize dog. So as punishment, he tells the little serf boy to take off running, and then he sicks his hounds on him, and they go and tear him apart as his mother watches, as he forces his mother to watch, and so on and so forth. Well, and then the position that Ivan takes is he doesn't deny the existence of God. He doesn't deny anything that the priest would want to claim about God. All that's fine of good and good, but I say to God, you can have your ticket back. I'm not interested. You are so, you, God, are so obnoxious to me that I'm not interested in having anything to do with you. Well, that's a very different kind of argument. That's not an argument, a philosophical argument, about what is true. It's rather an appeal to what I should do in response. How should I interact with this God? Should I embrace him? Should I acknowledge him? Should I honor him? Or should I defy him and respond in rebellion to him? And evil then is used, and particularly suffering, is used as the rationale for why I should defy him and rebel against him. And this is never stated, but it's pretty clear reading between the lines. It's an argument that you should think of yourself as morally superior to God. If you were God, you wouldn't run the universe this way. You would do better. You are a better person than God. And out of that kind of hubris and that exalted sense of yourself, you stand above God in judgment over God.
Jack, don't we all at one time or another think that?
Sure.
I'd do a better
very,
job.
Very common. Very common, yeah. And I think it's just part of human rebellion, ultimately, that we're attracted to that perspective.
But to some degree, don't we usually think that in the context of when the question of evil is usually a very abstract? We usually abstract evil, so we'll talk about, well, I'd rescue all the children of the world, kind of make the suffering an abstract argument. Rarely do we look at our own suffering and say, well, if I were God, I wouldn't put myself through this.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
That's exactly true.
Yeah.
And just in passing, what's interesting is the kind of argument that's made here is never made by philosophers. I shouldn't say never, but that's not where you go to find an argument like this. It's like in Brothers Karamazov, it's in a novel. It's novelists, storytellers, poets. It's people who make fiction who make this kind of appeal. Philosophers know that however emotionally compelling that case might be, philosophically it doesn't hold any water. It doesn't prove nothing. And that's what I'm going to show in my argument, that as a philosophical argument, evil gets you really basically nowhere. It doesn't prove that God doesn't exist. It doesn't prove that he's not good. It doesn't prove that he's not sovereign. It can't do that. But it sure is a powerful and compelling argument to kind of light the fires of your rebellion and your defiance. And in that respect, it's very compelling to people. It resonates with that rebellion in us, like Paul was talking about, and really fires us up.
Question. Is it possible to posit a good but naive person who is still in the process of trying to figure out, he doesn't have any teaching or anything, to take on creative, somebody like maybe Jesus even as a young lad trying to figure out who God was, he's perfectly good, and he sees this evil, and he's still in the process of thinking about, what do I do with this? And that for a moment you can imagine him considering, well, one possibility is that God isn't good. Mm-hmm. So just the fact that we say, this is really rather startling. This is not what I would expect. So asking the question itself, I guess my point is, isn't necessarily rebellious.
No. I'm making a distinction between the philosophical issues and the emotional fire of rebellion. Those are great. Sorry, I should have faced them. All of those arguments could be dealt with. I'm going to focus specifically on number four there. Evil as an argument against divine determinism, because that's what I find the most interesting, given that I'm committed to the position that divine determinism is the biblical perspective on God. But what I have to say will have relevance to almost all of these arguments, but I'm just not going to focus on them. So, given that I'm going to focus on this as an argument against divine determinism, let's be clear what I mean by divine determinism. Divine determinism has the following tenets. One is it holds that God transcends reality, transcends created reality. And there it's critical to understand what I mean by that. Every Christian in Christian culture will say that God is transcendent. But most Christians, what they mean by transcendent is that God transcends the material physical universe. He lives in the spiritual half of created reality, not the physical and material half of created reality. So, to be logical, I mean, I don't know how they would actually respond, but if you would ask them, well, are angels transcendent? To be logically consistent, they'd have to say, oh yeah, angels are transcendent too. And so are ghosts and leprechauns. That anything that's not a visible, physical, material being is transcends material, physical reality. That's mostly how Christians think about transcendence. I'm making a different claim than that. The Bible is saying that God actually transcends created reality altogether. God is an uncreated being. God is not real. God is super real. Above reality, beyond reality, more than real, more real than real than we are real. Because he has a being that cannot not be. He just is. Thus, I think his name, Yahweh, the one who is. Whereas we are created beings, and every nanosecond of my life is utterly and completely dependent on one more real than me willing me into existence. If God did not want me to exist the next nanosecond, then it wouldn't happen. So my existence is completely dependent, completely contingent on the will of God allowing me to go on, or actually willing me to go on. So I exist with a different kind of existence than God does. Philosophers make the distinction, God has necessary existence, we have contingent existence. Well, as such then, he's not in the same category as we are. He doesn't live within the box of contingent existence, of being like I am being, of existing like I am existing, of being real like I am real. He's not there. He's above that and beyond that and outside of that. That's what I mean by transcendence. He is above and beyond being. Is that everybody clear on that? So he just, it's not like we all live in the same house and he lives upstairs and we live downstairs. He doesn't live in the house at all. He's the builder, architect, maker of the house, but he lives in an entirely different part of it. I can't finish that metaphor. Do you know what I mean? Okay, any questions on that? So that's a critical to the position I'm calling divine determinism, is that he transcends reality.
So if the universe were destroyed, God would still exist.
Yeah, you could erase the universe, and you wouldn't even touch God. He'd still exist. From his place of transcendence, point two, from his place of transcendence, God determines every aspect of everything that is and of everything that occurs. So that there is literally nothing in this universe that is not completely and totally and deliberately and purposely willed, scripted, if you will, by God. And I mean everything. There is no random noise in God's universe. So every little subatomic particle is doing exactly what the author of reality wants that subatomic particle to do. So when quantum physics brings randomness into the picture, there is no real randomness in the universe, is the contention of divine determinism. Not really. We may not be able to predict the outcome. We may not know the causes. And so we call them random. But that doesn't mean they're random to God. It doesn't mean they're outside of his determinative control. Three, and this will be critical to my whole argument, created reality has a narrative structure. The reality that God has created from the beginning of Genesis 1 on is not a thing. It's a story. God didn't create a bunch of gadgets. We are not widgets or gadgets or products, or we didn't come off the assembly line because he wanted a human being. And who knows what that human being's going to do, and who knows what that human being's going to be, but I want a human being in existence. So God said, let there be a human being, there is a human being. God didn't create me a human being. He created me the protagonist in a story. He created you as the protagonist in your story. and all of reality is a set of interlocking, very interesting interlocking stories. And all of those stories then are brought together and interlocked and interconnected in such a way that there's this overarching grand narrative that brings coherence and sense and unity to all those individual stories in existence. And the stories are not just the stories of human beings. Literally every subatomic particle is a part of the story of its existence. So this is not at all incompatible with modern science and what it knows and what it has discovered. All I'm saying is that from a biblical perspective, God, the creator of all reality, has created people and has created things, and all of them are subject to his will, and everything that exists in its own kind of way has an existence that has the structure of a narrative, a story. A story is being told by that being that he brought into existence. Okay, that'll be critical to my argument. Any questions on that? So putting those last two points together then, who is God? God is the author of reality, and when I say author there, I'm meaning that more profoundly than many Christians mean that when they use that. A lot of times God is said to be the author of reality, but they just mean the origin. That's all they really mean by that. I mean more than that. It's not just that he's the origin of reality, he's the author in the sense that he's creating a story, or a set of stories, really. He's creating a set of stories. So God's relationship to human beings is analogous, I would argue, to an author's relationship to the characters in a novel that he's writing. They're exactly analogous. They have the same kind of relationship. And specifically, point B then, what is that relationship? God affects human choice by transcendently causing the free will choices of human beings. He does not cause human choice through ordinary causation. He causes it through transcendent causation. I will come back to that. I'll revisit that a little bit later in the notes. But this is critical to understanding what I'm calling divine determinism, that God has a relationship to human beings such that we are free. We are absolutely, we have free will in every sense that we have ever thought that we have free will. That's not an illusion, it's real. We absolutely have free will. And it's also true that everything I do with my free will is scripted by the author of reality, caused and determined by him. And the secret to understanding how those are reconcilable is to understand the difference between transcendent causation and what I'm calling ordinary causation. God causes me to freely choose what I choose by transcendently causing me to choose what I choose, not causing me in the ordinary sense to do what I do. We'll revisit that. I'll talk about that more a little bit later. And then finally, and I think this is critical to the biblical worldview, created reality is a story that is created to give expression to the goodness of God. The purpose of the story is not to promote the well-being of each and every creature within the story. This, again, will be critical to my argument. From a biblical perspective, God did not create the world for me. God did not create reality because he wanted to have a home for me when he created me. That's mostly how Christians tend to think about it. And so, and frankly, that's mostly how human beings tend to think about it. Our attitude is, God, you gave me existence, you better make it worth my while. That's where we go. But notice the assumptions behind that. Well, you gave me existence because you wanted to make me happy and make me prosper and make me flourish here. I mean, that's the whole purpose of my existence, isn't it? Because this is for me, right? Well, I think if we're going to understand the biblical worldview, we have to understand that's exactly wrong. I was brought into existence to be a protagonist in a story, and the meaning and the significance of that story is going to be to reflect on the storyteller, the author. The story exists for the sake of the storyteller, not the characters in the story. And that's absolutely critical to understanding my argument. We will revisit that a little bit. So that's divine determinism. Now, what I'm calling, I will use the term throughout here, biblical divine determinism. And what I mean by biblical divine determinism is the combination of divine determinism and an emphasis on the goodness of God, the traditional Judeo-Christian concept of God being perfectly good. Those in combination is what I'm going to call biblical divine determinism. And the point I'm making is you could actually embrace biblical divine determinism and still argue that God's not a very good person, not a very good being. Well, from a biblical perspective, as James puts it in James, he is the father of lights in whom there is not even the least hint of deviation. So and I think what James is saying there is that that's how utterly, perfectly, unqualifiedly, uncorrupted, uncompromisingly good God is. There's not an ounce of evil in him. That's biblical divine determinism. Everything that I just said about divine determinism is true, and God is perfectly good. No. Because I'm going to use it differently throughout here, and at any point where you're not clear what I mean by it, let's use it there. But there's a difference between moral goodness and ontological goodness, the goodness of something that exists because it exists. And I'm going to use it both ways, but I'm going to argue that part of the fact, see, that God is morally good, if we claim that God is morally good, it's because he's making ontologically good things. That's part of our understanding. Goodness is very difficult, if not impossible, to define. G.E. Moore says, goodness is like yellow. Can't define it, but you just know what it is. Okay, so my contention is, I'm at F now, the following statements are true of biblical divine determinism, and I mean to contrast them with other theistic positions that people can take within the Judeo-Christian tradition. One, on the face of it, biblical divine determinism would seem to be the theistic position, the way of believing in God, that is most vulnerable to the problem of evil. On the face of it, that would seem to be true. Because look at all the resources that Christians use to defend God with other theistic positions. God didn't create evil. He gave us free will, and he doesn't want to violate our free will, so we just act out of our free will, and that's how we introduce evil into the world. I don't have recourse to that argument, because God controls my free will. God is not the cause of evil. Satan is the cause of evil. Demons are the cause of evil. God didn't cause the hurricanes. He just made nature, and nature did it. There's all kinds of ways that peep edge on the nature and extent of God's control over reality, and because they limit it, they limit it in certain significant ways, they leave a space for evil to come from there, from outside of God's control. Well, I don't have recourse to that, because as a divine determinist, I've said God controls absolutely everything. There isn't a subatomic particle or a single nanosecond of time that God has not purposed to be exactly as it is. So because I'm advocating absolute control over everything, I have no recourse to making the origin of evil be not God's fault, if you understand what I'm saying. So on the face of it, it would seem like my position is going to be the hardest to defend against the problem of evil. But what I would argue is that ultimately, biblical divine determinism is the only theistic position with the resources to adequately answer and resolve the problem of evil. And those resources are going to rest in its position that created reality has a narrative structure, that it's a story, and that goodness, therefore, is ultimately going to be defined in the context of the goodness of a story, the goodness of a creation in that sense. That created reality is not just there, it has meaning, it has significance, it has truth, it has beauty, it has glory to it, it has substance to it. And what I'm going to ultimately argue is the evil that God has created is part of the substance and goodness of the story itself. And because it's part of the goodness and the substance of the story itself, the significance and message of the story itself, it makes sense that it's there. Because if God's going to create a good story, he's going to create everything that contributes to the goodness of that story. Well, no other theistic position has the resources to understand it in that way, because they don't take seriously the narrative structure of reality. I didn't for years. Even as a divine determinist, I didn't even see that part for a long time. It's just been in more recent years that I've realized what a powerful truth that is, and how critical it is to understanding everything that the Bible teaches. So, in my mind, it's the fact that evil can finally be resolved and accounted for. I don't mean understood. I'm not going to argue that I understand why God does all the evil he does. In fact, it'll become clear that I don't. Not that I understand all the evil, but I have a worldview that makes sense of why it might be there. And it's only by biblical divine determinism can give me that worldview. And in my mind, that's one argument for believing in the biblical perspective, the biblical divine determinism, is because it can account for everything, including evil. Because any worldview that can't account for evil, how can it be true? Because that evil, sure enough, is out there. And in any worldview, it needs to be able to account for what's out there. So it's a strong argument in my mind for the truth of biblical divine determinism, that it can make sense out of the existence of evil. A? G, let's go on. Responding to the problem of evil, some preliminary points of clarification. So before we actually get into the part of my argument, there's some important things to get out of the way first. One, the standard of goodness that we must use to judge the goodness of God is the ordinary concept of goodness that we apply in ordinary, everyday moral judgment. It is a concept and standard that we share with God himself. You will oftentimes hear Christians resort to the expedience, well, God is good, but he's good in a different sense than we normally mean that. Well, okay, I mean, you can say that, but notice that that doesn't even begin to respond to the problem of evil. Because the problem of evil is not saying, I don't think you should attach the word good to God. What the problem of evil is saying is, we all have a sense of goodness, right? Well, God's not that. Whatever he is, he's not that. And if you object and say, yeah, but I want to call him good, you could see someone who's advancing an argument from evil saying, okay, call him good all you want, but he's not what I mean by good. Because that's the only thing that's relevant to the problem. That's the only thing that's relevant to the argument, is the application of our concept of good and asking the question, using my concept of good, would you predicate that of God? Would you say that God is that? So we've already stipulated that we're using our everyday, ordinary concept of good. Is that clear? That is the problem with you.
Would we know there are no evil?
I'd have to say I think it's possible. If God had created a different reality that was good and only good and there were no evil, we wouldn't know it by way of contrast, but we would still know it. I mean, for example, ask yourself the question, would we know existence if there were no non-existence? But there is non-existence.
Well, I think everybody's, or not everybody, but a number of people's concept of heaven is a place where it's only good.
Uh-huh, yeah, right. I don't know. I'm not sure how to answer that question. But I shouldn't think that's actually one very common response to the problem of evil in Christian tradition, is to say that God needed to create the contrast. Well, needed to? I mean, you could imagine God saying in Genesis 1:1, let there be the kingdom, everlasting kingdom of God, and there was the everlasting kingdom of God, and there was no pain, and there was no suffering, and there was no evil in it, and everybody lived happily ever after. I can imagine that, and we'd be just fine.
A very short book.
Yeah, it'd be a very short Bible, yeah. But living in that and dwelling in that and experiencing that kingdom, that'd be another way to go, and it would be fine. I wouldn't be missing out on anything. The fact that I didn't know evil would make me different than I am. But it's not like God couldn't have done that, it seems to me. I don't see how you can make that case. So, I mean, on the one hand, clearly our understanding of goodness is in complete contrast with evil, and it certainly enhances our understanding of good in a way that not having evil, I'd be at a deficit.
You might not know that it's good, but we just know that it is.
Yeah, exactly. That's
Because there's nothing in contrast.
That's right. Okay. That's right.
Like I said earlier, there are some theories that say that we need evil to mature in our lives. That if we didn't know evil, we wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. We'll kind of get into some of that. That's a good example of the difference between the tools that most Christians are working with and what I'm arguing are the tools that we actually have in the Bible. And that is, they have to find a way to try to make the case that in order for God to get to point B, he had to use suffering and evil as a means to that. What I'm going to argue is that suffering and evil is not a means to the end that God wanted to achieve, because it's actually not true that God couldn't have got to point B. If God is God, all he'd have to do is create me with all of my maturity intact. Let Jack be mature. And he was mature. I mean, it's just bang. And so that leaves open the question, well, why didn't it? And in our way of thinking, especially as Americans, that we need a technique, we need a procedure, we need some mechanism to get people produced the way they're produced. God must be using a mechanism. He must be using some technique to get us there. Well, God doesn't need a technique. He can just will it to be, and it will be. So that leaves open the question, well, why did he do it this way that entails the existence of evil and suffering instead of just creating ex nihilo? Why didn't he just out of nothing make us mature? The answer to that has to be because there's some kind of meaning and significance in the suffering and evil being there in itself.
Does it?
If not, then it's inexcusable that he didn't just create us that way.
Does it?
I mean, I think so.
If God's an author and he wants to write a story that his son, who needs a job, is a good actor, and he's creating a story so his son can act in it and do well in this story, that may be the only reason he did it that way. Not because it was... So, in order for his son to show off his acting talents, he had to... there had to be evil, and he had to overcome it, or something like that, and that's kind of simplifying.
But I think you're making my point.
Right, I am.
Yeah.
But you were saying, unless there's another, you said it would be inexcusable for him to do it unless there was some purpose for us suffering.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I misspoke. From the set of assumptions that most Christians have, then it would be inexcusable for God to use an evil means to bring about good ends if he didn't have to.
Right.
But what I'm saying is, this is evil and sin are not a means to a good end. They are part of the goodness itself, which is what you're proposing.
Yeah.
If what was Paul or Alan was talking about, if the world had only goodness and what Judy said, and maturity, would there be any need for the son who is a good actor?
Yeah, arguably not. I mean, that's the whole point, is that what God is creating is a story of redemption with a redeemer at the center of it. That's the story that's being told. And so it would be a very incoherent story if you created the redeemer at the center of a story where there is no redemption and no need for redemption. That's a bad story.
So could you summarize that by saying the universe that had evil at some point in its existence is better than a universe that never had evil?
No, I wouldn't say that. I don't think the potential stories that God would tell can be evaluated against each other. The story that starts in the beginning, God said, let there be an eternal kingdom of righteousness and truth, and there was one, would also be a great story. But it's a different story.
Okay, so the answer is it's the story he wanted to tell.
Exactly. And the story we're a part of.
And Ken, is the category good then? I mean, if you use the category good, it seems like you're evaluating it. So do we even use the term good to refer to that? It's a story. It can be consistent or inconsistent or coherent or whatever. Is it good because God is good and he told the story?
No, I think the story is good because the story is good, not bad. But we need not, that's, if you want a pretty good discussion of good, is in Principia Ethica by G.E. Moore. And
you don't have to get a prick in your neck, you can look forward to
it. Okay. Part of what Moore argues is that there's lots of different goods in the world, and we know them when we see them. But there's different ways of being good and different kinds of good. But good is good, and every good thing is good. And I think there's something very true about what he's saying there. So unlike Leibniz, who says this is the best of all possible worlds, where he has this perspective that we have to measure whether something is more good than something else, whether it's more perfect than something else. And there, this world, in order for God to be good, this has to be the best of all possible worlds. Otherwise, God is incriminated for not having created the best one. But isn't it also possible that there are innumerable different good worlds that God could have created, and this is one of them? I mean, why does it have to be the best of all possible worlds? Why can't it just be good, a good creation, a perfectly worthy creation to exist that has a meaning and significance to it that was well worth bringing to be? And remember my assumption in biblical divine determinism, this is not about us, this is about God. It's the story itself and how it reflects on him, the storyteller, that it is what we need to measure it by. Not by individual outcomes for individual beings and individual creatures and so on. This is a very obnoxious perspective to the modern world that is so far from what any human being is inclined to think, and particularly any modern is inclined to think. You know, most people on the street would go, you've got to be kidding me, you are out of your beloved mind to have that, to take God so seriously that existence itself is about God. That's outrageous. But it's the biblical perspective, I believe.
Okay. Would you object to saying that God preferred this story? I mean, the way you described it sounds like God chose this at random.
No, I shouldn't. I wouldn't assume that it's a random. Yeah, I don't have any objection that he preferred it, but I don't think we're in any position to know what the criteria of preference were.
It met his objectives.
Sorry?
It met his objectives.
It met his objective, exactly.
Could there be any number of stories being told elsewhere?
I can't rule it out.
That reflect other qualities of the creed.
Exactly. I don't think we can rule that out. Exactly.
So there's a comedy going on somewhere else.
There's a comedy going on.
It's possible.
But we would never know that because we can't transcend into
reality. Because we will never be outside this story. Yeah, exactly. So we could never know that.
Unless,
not now and not in eternity.
Unless the Creator finds a way to reveal it.
Yeah, maybe there's a library and there can't
Listen, I would argue for the best of all possible worlds is I can't think of how God would decide between his many options unless if we're deciding between options and we feel equally drawn to them, we can flip a coin. God can't flip a coin. And so the only criterion I can think you could use would be goodness. What is the better one? And that's why I've always found righteousness, or to the extent that I understand it, persuasive. Because unlike us, who can use randomness or pseudo-randomness, because it's not random to God, God doesn't have access to randomness. So he's got
God to can't create a random number generator?
No. There are advantages to being finite that he doesn't have.
Right. So I can't think of any other criterion
that he could use except for goodness.
Okay. Isn't that Jack's point about how we can't tell, or we can't know how he chooses his preference for how thing turns out? We can just tell that, well, it seems to be a good story. Not and yeah, to us it might be that the only criterion we can think of is that, well, this must be the best possible outcome for whatever's going on, but that might not be how God's determining the way that the story's going.
And remember, I mean, that I think that's the point of Bill's question. God wouldn't have to choose if he's telling multiple stories. So that's another possibility.
Maybe we can create randomness. I mean, if God's telling our story, and so he's writing it, then seems like it would be impossible for even us to generate anything that's random.
No, that's why I call it pseudo-randomness. It's not random from God's perspective at all, but from our perspective, we can't predict it, so that's what we need to
say. So nothing random ever happens.
That's right.
It can't really happen at all.
That's right.
Okay.
Then the other, we were talking about the concept of goodness, point G, number one. B, since we are created in the image of God, it stands to reason that God would have created us to share in and reflect his own standard and concept of goodness. So it actually is very plausible that we do have the same concept of goodness as God does anyway. I mean, not only does the problem of evil, I'm not concerned about God's standard of goodness, I'm saying, is he good by my standard of goodness? So that's the question. So it doesn't do any good to say God has a different standard of goodness. But I'm going further in saying it's actually very plausible that he has exactly the same standard of goodness that we have, because we're made in his image. And wouldn't part of being made in his image most likely entail that he created us to be beings who can know, can understand, can interact with, and employ the same concept of goodness that is inherent and intrinsic to God himself? That's plausible to me. Now, there is an important disclaimer, though. Since we are also, from a biblical perspective, rebellious and foolish sinners, it is possible and probable that we can have a distorted understanding of this concept of goodness. That is, we're fully capable of knowing goodness as God does, but do we? But do we have a perfect grasp of that? Well, we all know from the biblical teaching that there's a distorting lens that enters into our experience, our rebellion, our passion against God, our rejection of God, and everything that God stands for. And then we rationalize our rebellion by self-stupefaction, making ourselves dumb, making ourselves not know what we should know. As Paul puts it in Romans, we suppress the truth in unrighteousness. So, I can't be so proud as to think, well, I have a concept of goodness, and it's a good concept of goodness, and God better dance to my tune. I need to have the humility to realize, do I really have that good of a grasp on what it means to be good? Probably not. So I need to have some humility there. Okay, the second point. So the first one was that the standard of goodness that's relevant is our ordinary standard of goodness. The second thing to recognize is that all moral judgment is dependent upon how an act or an event is characterized or described. This gets very confusing in ethics, because an ethical judgment needs to first describe the act that is passing judgment on. I first have to describe what the act is that I'm going to declare to be either good or evil. Well, what's the right, proper, appropriate, thorough description of that act? So let me give you some examples. If I talk about a mugger cutting someone's abdomen open with a knife, and then I describe a surgeon as cutting someone's abdomen open with a knife, if I ask myself the question, is it good or evil to cut someone's abdomen open with a knife? Notice I'm going to pass a different moral judgment on that if it's a surgeon doing it as opposed to a mugger doing it. So before I can pass judgment on the act, I have to bring a lot more information into my description of what exactly the act is that I'm passing judgment on. So it's critical that we have a thorough, complete, accurate, and exhaustive description of the act that I'm judging. Furthermore, no act can be accurately judged to be evil or to be good unless one has rightly understood the role, authority, position, relationships, and prerogatives of the one who's doing the act. So, again, note the different moral judgment one makes of a husband being sexually intimate with his wife as over against an adulterous neighbor being sexually intimate with that same woman. I will make a different moral judgment. Why? Because there's different relationships between the two participants. One is an adulterer, the other is a husband to the woman. And I'm going to pass a different moral judgment because there's different relationships in the actors of the event or the act. And morality has to take that into account. Moral judgment has to take that into account. If I treat a female as a child, it makes a difference whether that female is my daughter or my wife. I'm going to have pass a different moral judgment on that depending upon the nature of the relationship. So putting those two together, point C, when passing moral judgment on God, a person must make his judgment in accordance with an accurate and complete description of God's action. And that judgment must include a recognition that as the author of all reality, there are certain prerogatives that belong to him, to God, that do not belong to any human creature. So I have to take that into account. Oftentimes in the debate and the discussion about whether God is evil, God is described as doing all kinds of things that are completely inappropriate descriptions of what God has done. God murdered my child. When my child dies in an accident, and in my anger, I might say, God murdered my child. Well, is that an accurate description of what God actually did? Note the different moral judgment made of a murderer purposely causing a person to have an automobile accident in which that person dies, as opposed to God doing likewise. So some linkage falls off. I don't know, do cars have linkage? But some linkage falls off of something in a car, and somebody has an accident and dies. Well, if God, through the laws of physics and randomness and other things, brings that mechanical defect in the car that causes the death of someone, is that morally equivalent to some murderer wanting someone to die and purposely creating a mechanical defect that's going to cause an accident and potentially the death of that person? Are those morally equivalent? Well, I think most of us are prepared to answer no, those aren't morally equivalent. God is being God. The murderer is being a murderer. And there's nothing wrong with God being God. There is something wrong with the murderer being a murderer. When God causes the death of some person, a person P, he's not murdered person P. That would be an inaccurate description of God's act. God purposely ends every human being's existence. God, as God, purposely ends every person's existence. That's what part of what it means to be God. It is his prerogative as the creator. One could never justly describe as murder God's purposely taking a human being's life. But that's exactly what we define as murder if it's a human being purposely taking someone else's life. So we have to be very careful that we are attaching the right description, the right characterization of God's action if we're going to make a moral judgment about it.
So are we saying that God's the biggest bully in the universe? He can do whatever he wants and whatever he does is good because he's God and he can do it?
No, we're not saying that.
So why is that a mischaracterization of what you just said?
Because he's not the biggest. Well, there's several things wrong with that. Can we say that?
Yes.
Because I think several of the points I'm making will be partial answers to that question. So if I have not answered that by 3 o'clock, can you ask it again? So what's the right moral judgment to make with regard to the act of God causing person M to shoot person P to death? So this is not just God causing an accident now. What if he causes me to freely choose to shoot somebody to death, to murder them? How should I characterize that? Did God kill you if I shoot you and he caused me to do that? Did God kill you? Did God murder you? You could characterize it that way, and now you have your moral judgment. It was evil. But isn't it more accurate to say that for God to cause me to kill you, is God created a murderer? He created me a murderer, and he created me to murder as a murderer. That's a different act from actually committing the act of murder. Committing murder is evil. Creating murder, well, we have to evaluate whether that's evil or not. But it's not as obviously evil as if he committed a murder. So the whole point is we need to take great care how we describe and define and characterize what it is that God has and has not done. When we judge God differently from how we judge a human being doing essentially the same thing, it does not necessarily mean or entail that we are using a different standard of goodness for God rather than the human being. That's how it gets characterized. But no, it's not a different standard of goodness. More likely what we are doing is simply acknowledging God's unique relationship to reality. God can relate to reality in a way differently than I as a human being can relate to reality, and because he's God, and God has certain relationship and certain prerogatives that come from that relationship that I don't have as a creature. It's God's prerogative to decide when you will begin to exist and when you will end to exist. That's not my prerogative. I'm playing God if I do that. And that's the fundamental evil of murder. The fundamental evil of murder is not the violence. It's not the force. It's not... The fundamental evil of murder is the hubris that I, as a mere creature, would decide that your existence should end. That's what makes murder evil. That's a whole other story. But so how we characterize what God is doing, and as we do that, we need to take into account his unique relationship to reality. Otherwise, our whole discussion will get hopelessly muddled. Why? No, let's go just a little bit longer. So H, now I'm going to go over H and I rather quickly. What I've done here is just for the record, is I've articulated an argument from evil against divine determinism, a step-by-step premise, conclusion type argument. And this is the argument I'm going to be interacting with. Premise one, if a divine being exists who is perfectly and flawlessly good, then it is not possible for both of the following to be true. First, that divine determinism is true, and what I mean by that is that God is the author and determiner of everything that is and of every aspect of everything that occurs. That's not possible if God is perfectly and flawlessly good, and for it also to be true that created reality contains inexcusable evil. Okay, so here's the point. These three things can't all be true. God is good, reality contains inexcusable evil, and that's the word I'm going to use It's just my shorthand for an evil that ought not to exist in a good universe. So that's what I mean by inexcusable. There's no excuse for it being there. Okay? So for created reality to contain inexcusable evil cannot coexist with God being good and God being in control, the cause and determiner of everything that exists. Those are logically incompatible realities. That's my first premise, the first premise of this argument. Now, as a matter of fact, created reality does contain inexcusable evil, so this argument goes. That's where we're going to spend most of our time, is asking, is that a true premise? Does reality contain inexcusable evil? Do I know that? But as far as this argument is concerned, they just posit that. Look around. Isn't it obvious? Created reality does contain inexcusable evil. Well, from 1 and 2 then, it follows, therefore, if a divine being exists who is perfectly and flawlessly good, and inexcusable evil exists, then it follows that divine determinism is not true. It cannot be true. So premise 1 together with premise 2 lead to premise 3 as a sub-conclusion. 4, as a matter of biblical teaching and faith, a divine being exists who is perfectly and flawlessly good. The Bible teaches us that God is good, so it follows from 3 and 4 that divine determinism is not true. So that's the argument. Do you have a sense for the argument? I don't want to analyze the logic of it and take the time to do that, but do you have a sense for the argument? Just very simply, how can God be good if there's inexcusable evil in the world and God could have done something about it? Well, we know he's good. Divine determinism says he could have done something about it, but there sure enough is inexcusable evil in the world. Since all three of those things can't be true, he must not be able to do anything about it. In other words, divine determinism is not true. That's the sense of the argument. Now, logic working the way it does, see, if I have an argument that's a valid argument, maybe the premises are true, maybe the premises are not true, but I have a valid argument that if this is true, and if this is true, and if this is true, then this follows. That's a valid argument. But I know the conclusion is false to that argument. Then the only way the conclusion can be false is if one of the premises is false. So let's look at another valid argument to stack up against this argument here, the 1 and H. So I is a counter-argument. If we know, independently of any judgment about the nature and extent of evil in created reality, that biblical divine determinism is in fact true. So I read the Bible, I study the Bible, I'm a competent interpreter of the Bible, and I come to realize, you know what? Biblical divine determinism is what the Bible teaches. I believe what the Bible teaches. I'm going to take my stand on that. I know that that's true. So let's say we know that's true. Well, that's in conflict with the conclusion of the argument just above. Okay, so we know that the biblical divine determinism is true. Then the argument above can be converted into an argument against the existence of inexcusable evil in the world. In other words, I'm challenging one of the premises. I'm saying that premise is false. So that would go like this. One is the same premise as in the first argument. If a divine being exists who is perfectly and flawlessly good, then it is not possible for both of the following to be true. For divine determinism to be true on the one hand, and secondly, for created reality to contain inexcusable evil. Therefore, if biblical divine determinism is true, in fact, then it follows that created reality does not contain inexcusable evil. Now, as a matter of biblical teaching and faith, biblical divine determinism is true. Therefore, it follows that created reality does not contain inexcusable evil. Now, both of those arguments are equally valid, logically. What that means, then, is that the problem of evil, or the argument from evil, hasn't really proved anything definitive. All it's done is it's highlighted the fact that we have a choice to make which premise we think is true. And I've called them premise one and premise two here in point J. Premise one, created reality does contain inexcusable evil. We could embrace that premise. And if we embrace that premise, then we're going to consider the argument in H to be a sound argument and to lead to a true conclusion. But there's premise two, biblical divine determinism is true. If I embrace, for whatever reason, if I embrace that premise, then it makes more sense for me to embrace argument I as a sound argument leading to a sound and true conclusion. So the argument from evil proves one, it only proves definitively one and only one thing, and that is that both premise one and premise two cannot be true, or they cannot both be true. One or the other of them has to be false. It can't prove that premise two is false because it can't prove that either of them is false. It doesn't have the philosophical power to be able to compel me either way. So the difference between the biblical divine determinist and the detractor of divine determinism consists in the following. The detractor of divine determinism embraces premise one, that inexcusable evil exists in created reality. They embrace premise one because he thinks our experience of the world makes it obvious that there is inexcusable evil in the world. Now, in the remainder of what I have to say are devoted largely to assessing whether or not it's obvious that inexcusable evil exists in the world. The bulk of my notes are going to be concerned with that question. On the other hand, the biblical divine determinist embraces premise two, and he embraces premise two because he thinks that the data of biblical revelation and the data of philosophical reflection can't be adequately explained by any other view. So because he embraces premise two, then he accepts argument in I, the argument in I and not the argument. Now, it's beyond the scope of my notes here to make the case for biblical divine determinism. And then an advertisement for getting my book and reading it. If you're, or feel that that's a good thing. Okay, we'll take a break here.